podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Hello, and welcome to the Lannan Readings and Conversations. I'm Ben Marcus. Tonight, I'm pleased to introduce John DeGatta, who will be reading. John DeGatta writes literary essays, but as Mr. DeGatta himself has observed, the essay, as it often appears in magazines, has been over-parented, helicopter-parented, made to behave according to fearful rules, forced to obey the factual, the quotidian, the known, and therefore robbed of its artistic legacy, going back to Cicero, to Plutarch, of being a deeply beguiling, complex art form that is far more slippery than most of us might think. Think of the disruptive genius of Orwell, or Sontag and her maverick intelligence, or Borges, whose love of false factual tones defined his fiction. In one way or another, they all rescued the impossible from oblivion. They carved out a place for unprecedented feeling to live inside of their pages. These are writers who answered to no one but themselves, which is to say, artists. To me, that's the better way to understand John DeGatta as an artist, and this is the league to which he belongs: Orwell, Borges, Sontag, Didion. His essays are orphaned from any strict overseers, inventing themselves out of the heartbreak and paradox of our time, fueled by the passions, instincts, and astounding lyrical gifts of a writer unlike any other in the language. Mr. DeGatta's work is about so many things. I could list these topics for you, but they would not tell you enough. Instead, I can say that DeGatta writes what we don't know, what we have yet to feel, what we have yet to think. In other words, Mr. DeGatta is as virtuosic and explosive as we expect our poets to be. But whereas a poet's vernacular might be so evolved we need a special magnifying glass to understand it, Mr. DeGatta's prose is sheer and lucid, more like a chemical shot to our blood than mere words on a page. He has the expansive imagination of a novelist, which sometimes gets him into trouble, because an essayist with an imagination is a double threat. And he harnesses his interests, personal and intellectual, with such formal authority, such a technical command of the language, that we find he could convince us of perhaps anything. This leads to just one of the controversial things about Mr. DeGatta, his promiscuous relationship to facts. Certainly in a time of lawsuits and scolding cultural wardens, a time of deep paranoia against the beautiful and necessary counterfactual strategies of literature, nonfiction like Mr. DeGatta's that sometimes falls on the wrong side of veracity is not always easy to abide. The name nonfiction itself would seem to guarantee that nothing will be made up. Reviewers of DeGatta typically fall all over themselves in praise of his writing, then wring their hands about how he might have changed the shirt color of one of his subjects because he needed that color to appear on the shirt of that person at just that moment. To me, it's crucial to look at the moral and artistic intention behind such strategies. DeGatta never once deceives or belittles or takes advantage in his work. His adjustments are atmospheric, emotional, tonal, and always they are there to build our feeling for his subjects, his people, his places, his things. This is key. He opens wormholes of feeling in every sentence. He's a writer of staggering compassion, and to police him on the minor details, the facts that, as he argues, have nearly no lifespan at all, is to sever our capacity for joy and wonder and amazement. While we may not be able to trust him when it comes to the meaningless facts that sometimes litter our writing, we certainly can trust him when it comes to something far more important, the truth that only exists in the most compelling literary art. To me, it's very simple. We just need to ask, does he make us think and feel and revel and doubt and agonize and fear and love and tremble and celebrate? Well, yes, John DeGatta does. He does those things and more. Mr. Degatta has written two books, Halls of Fame, a collection of essays published by Gray Wolf, and About a Mountain, published by Norton. Halls of Fame put on a clinic for the gorgeous disguises an essay might take. And with this debut, Mr. Degatta quickly became regarded as a leading practitioner of not just the essay, but this new and yet really kind of ancient essay that sacrifices nothing, hunting its own truth in crystalline language. About a Mountain, Mr. Degatta's latest book, takes his ambition even further. It's a groundbreaking mixture of doomsday science, reportage, and what might only be called statistical lyricism. I'm very much hoping we'll hear a reading from it tonight. I won't say too much about it other than this. I read this book in a puddle of drooling envy. I wish I had written it. In addition to his own writing, Degatta is the editor of two seminal anthologies of essays, The Next American Essay, which shows the way for the literary essay going forward, and The Lost Origins of the Essay, which reaffirms the artistic tradition of the essay going back to the very first known instances of writing in Mesopotamia. In the last 10 years, Degatta has become the most articulate advocate of the essay as a work of art. His curatorial energies as an anthologist are unmatched. There's just no one else who better understands the history of the essay with all of its dazzling variations. Degatta has become instrumental in defining the genre to a generation of readers. It's a tremendous service he offers, and when added to his own brilliant writing, John Degatta clearly stands as an original literary figure in our time. And yet, even that somehow feels like an understatement. I'm honored to be here on this stage with him tonight. Please join me now in welcoming John Degatta.
Hi. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you, Ben, for saying that. Thank you to the Lannan Foundation as well for inviting me and for supporting me or showing me support for a lot longer than pretty much anyone else. I was remembering on the train ride over here, over and down from Iowa, that when I was in college and trying to figure out whether I was a writer or could be a writer and what it meant to be a writer and what a writer was, that I wasn't at a school that was particularly supportive. It was a great school, and I had great instructors, but we didn't have a writing program and not much of a writing community. But what we did have, I remembered, was in the library an entire set of the Lannan Readings and Conversation series, that VHS collection, which I borrowed and would bring up to a small windowless AV room to watch for hours at a time and whole afternoons trying to learn what a writer was and what they looked like and what they sounded like and whether I had anything in common with these people. So it's a great honor to be here, especially since often while watching those videos, I convinced myself that to be a part of this series meant that you had somehow made it as a writer. So by that logic, it is all downhill from this moment on. But it was probably at the time the best education I could have gotten, because it was me alone in a room kind of in conversation with these great writers who I then would go seek out and read up on. So it's incredibly cheesy for me to say this, but I'll say it because I'm feeling it, that I'm honored because the Lannan Foundation has actually been supporting me for a lot longer than they think they have. As goofy as that sounds. When I got to graduate school, I finally found a community of writers, a great writing program to be a part of. But still not that much support, because I wasn't really interested in writing the kind of nonfiction that was popular at the time. I had great instructors, but not that much support among my peers. But there was one student from the poetry side of the program who I didn't know very well at the time, but she came up to me one day with a book in her hand and handed it to me, and she said, "I've been reading your stuff." She didn't say essays, she said stuff, which was fine. She was at least reading it. And she handed me this book, and she said, "I think you'd really like this. I think you have something in common with this writer." And it was a book that had just come out. And I read it, I took it home, and devoured it, because I immediately did find kinship with this book and with this writer, who was doing something that wasn't going on in the program I was a part of, but was doing something that I did want to be a part of. And it's a book that's actually remained hugely influential for me still. And it was The Age of Wire and String, which was Ben's first collection of stories, actually, which I still think is one of the best collections of stories that our generation has produced so far. So it's been an honor to think of Ben now as a kind of colleague, but it's a huge honor for him to be here and for that introduction, and even for the conversation that I think will reveal me as a complete idiot. As I said, it is all downhill from this point. I'm going to read from this new book, from About a Mountain, which came out 1 year ago this week, I was reminded, by my publisher. I'm going to read something that's possibly a little risky to read. I'm going to read from a point near the end of the book straight on through to the very end of the book. And the reason why that's a bit risky is because I consider this book an essay, just one long, continuous book-length essay. And so by only giving you the ending of the book, the conclusion of the book, you'll be missing the impetus for the essaying, the impetus for this, the curiosity in the book, and you know, the supposed evidence that I'm piling up, factual or otherwise. So at the risk of introducing myself for too long, I just want to give you a bit of context for what I'm going to read. By talking about the two primary strands that are in the book, the two main stories. The first strand is Yucca Mountain, which I suspect in Santa Fe most people know about, have heard about. But just in case, so that we're all on the same page, Yucca is a mountain. It's in southwest Nevada. It's about 90 miles north of Las Vegas. And it's where, for the past 25 years approximately, the federal government has been considering storing all of this country's high-level nuclear waste, the super, super lethal stuff, the stuff that we've been accumulating at the 108-some-odd commercial nuclear power plants all around the country. About 77,000 tons of it so far that we've accumulated. The idea at Yucca is that we would take all of this waste from all of those commercial plants and truck them across the country. They'd converge in Vegas, and then they'd hop a train and be sent up north to Yucca Mountain, where at that point, about 40 years after we would have started that process of transporting the waste, we would have dug a series of tunnels out of Yucca Mountain. And so we would take this waste and basically just shove it in there. And after 40 years, after it was all in there, we would seal the mountain shut. And in the words of the Department of Energy, which is the federal agency in charge of Yucca Mountain, we would then return the mountain to its pristine natural state, as they put it. But obviously, while in that pristine natural state, 77,000 tons of nuclear waste would be inside the mountain, slowly degrading, slowly decomposing, and losing its lethality. The Department of Energy estimates that the average half-life of the waste that would be headed for Yucca Mountain would be about 10,000 years. In reality, if you ask most scientists not being paid by the federal government, the average half-life for the waste headed for Yucca Mountain is actually closer to about 28 million years. But the Department of Energy negotiated with the EPA, and they settled on 10,000 years, which is still a very long time, if you think about it. And it's so long that the Department of Energy realized that they would need, obviously, some way to mark Yucca Mountain, some way to let people in the future know that they shouldn't climb Yucca Mountain or build a house on Yucca Mountain or bomb it or drink water coming out of it, that they should stay away. One of, I think, the most remarkable things about the Yucca Mountain project is therefore this implicit acknowledgement on the part of the federal government that it probably isn't going to last for 10,000 years, that it can't simply place a guard in front of Yucca Mountain to tell people to stay away and just replace him or her over the 10,000-year period, that we're going to need a more passive way of letting future generations know that Yucca is dangerous. So what the Department of Energy did is they formed a committee. They formed a committee of 13 people made up of geologists and anthropologists and linguists, a hydrologist. There was a science fiction writer on the committee. And they called the committee the Expert Judgment Panel. And the Expert Judgment Panel's job was to find a way to mark Yucca Mountain, to find a way to build a sign that could remain not only physically intact for 10,000 years, but whose message, whose warning could remain coherent for 10,000 years. And if you think about it, that's a pretty difficult task. The committee almost immediately dismissed the idea, for example, of using language, because we don't have a language extant today that is 10,000 years old. And so it's very unlikely that any language we're currently using would last 10,000 years into the future. So what the committee started doing is thinking about this warning marker as not so much a sign, but more of an experience, something that we would sense when we came into the vicinity of Yucca Mountain. And we're going to hear about some of the designs that they came up with in the beginning of what I'm going to read. We'll also hear about the design that the Department of Energy ultimately decided to go with, because they dismissed their expert judgment panel's ideas and went with something of their own. The second strand in the book is suicide, and in particular, one suicide, the suicide of a boy in Las Vegas who killed himself by jumping off the top of the tallest building in Las Vegas, a hotel called the Stratosphere. The Stratosphere is it sort of looks like the Space Needle. It's the tallest building in Vegas, but also the tallest structure west of the Mississippi. It's about 1,400 feet high. And he jumped off the Stratosphere on a Saturday night, and he landed on the Strip, so it was very crowded and very public and pretty traumatic. And the way this boy and the suicide became a part of this story of the book is that while I was researching Yucca Mountain, my mom, somewhat out of the blue, decided to move to Las Vegas from our home in New Hampshire. And so I lived with her for a while, helping her settle while I was digging into Yucca Mountain. And she recommended that I start volunteering for the local suicide hotline, which is actually something that our family does. I hadn't ever done it by that point, but my mom had done it for decades back in New England. So I went through the training program of the local hotline, and on the very first night of my first shift on the hotline, I got a series of calls, but one in particular that was somewhat disturbing. It was from a very young-sounding person who didn't say very much and ultimately hung up on me. And I probably could have dismissed this somewhat easily, except that very same night later on, while watching the evening news with my mom, we saw a report of a boy who had killed himself by jumping off the top of the stratosphere. And possessing the kind of brain I possess, I immediately convinced myself that I had spoken to this person, that I was somehow involved in his suicide by not being able to give him what he needed over the phone. And so all while I was in town researching Yucca, I was secretly trying to figure out who that boy was who had killed himself at the stratosphere. And inevitably, his story, as well as the story of suicide in Vegas in general, which is a city that has more suicides every year than any other place in America, that story became a part of the Yucca story. They ended up speaking to each other, and by the end of my time in Vegas, they seemed inseparable. So we'll hear the tail end of my investigation into who that boy was in what I'll read. One thing I'll say about this boy, because you'll hear it referenced, is that he was a high school student in Vegas. He attended a public visual and performing arts high school, and he also did Taekwondo. He had studied Taekwondo for years and years and was quite good at it. I'll also say something about the form, because you're listening to this as opposed to reading it, and I just want to flag something for you. You'll hear some abrupt transitions in what I'll read, and that isn't because I'm jumping around and trying to paste a reading together. I'm actually reading straight on through without any breaks, and there aren't any pauses in what I'm going to read. So the roughness of the transitions are there in the book. They're actually intentional. I won't explain why I think they're necessary. That's your job if you care to take it up. But they are intended to be there. And then lastly, I'll say one thing that won't necessarily make sense. I'd like to give you permission to laugh during the reading, which sounds incredibly weird, but it'll be clear when I'm reading that we'll be wandering into some sensitive territory that might make you feel a bit uncomfortable, and yet occasionally there might be some funny things, possibly. I only bring this up because I've read this section before a few times, and I've noticed people in the audience occasionally giggling and then immediately covering their mouths because they felt that it was inappropriate for them to laugh. I would like to give you permission to laugh and to not worry about laughing. The tail end of this book that deals with this sensitivity is also full of lots of absurdities, and I think you're supposed to laugh. Let me also say I'm not begging you to laugh. I just want to give you that permission. So with that said, here we head downhill. Ten 10,000 years from now, Vega, not Polaris, will be our North Star. The space satellite Voyager, which was launched in 1979 and which has since been traveling 40,000 miles per hour, will be closer to the absolute emptiness of space than it will be to our home. Even the Earth's continents, which have been migrating slowly since they initially were formed, will be 850 feet farther apart. There will also be a new axial tilt in our planet. It will temporarily shift us away from the sun, lowering global temperatures by as much as 50 degrees. So around Yucca at that time, there will be a grassy plain. Most of Russia won't be inhabitable. Iran may be a ski resort. A new volcanic island will appear beside Hawaii. Plastic will be extinct because petroleum will be too. And while we won't be living longer than we currently are living, Frank Tipler's book, The Physics of Immortality, says that if we're wealthy, we'll be able to buy the brains of younger body donors, download our memories into those brains, and then live through them vicariously until we need another donor. We will be living underground, or we will be living in giant domes, or we will be living in a single networked city that sprawls across the planet called Ecumenopolis. Physicist John Fremlin believes, in fact, that the human population by the year 12,000 will be 61 trillion strong. Our food will have to be harvested from algae and cadavers and pumped into our homes as daily liquid rations. Rodney Brooks, the director of MIT's Artificial Intelligence Laboratory, believes, however, that humans are going to have such exquisite control over the genetics of living systems that instead of growing a tree, cutting it down, and then building a table from it, we ultimately will be able to just grow a table from scratch. Yet as Warwick Collins explains in his book Computer One, most of the work on the planet by the late 21st century will be conducted by a giant global supercomputer that will relegate humans to the role of pampered pets. It will control the water supply, the food supply, electricity, transportation. It will be programmed to repair itself and to anticipate situations that might necessitate more repairs. And this is the reason why, 500 years after we invest in building it, Computer One will calculate the chances that human beings might interfere with the work it's programmed to do. It will reason that interferences are a threat to its efficiency, and it will logically conclude that it could raise its productivity if humans were not around. It will be quiet on the Earth. There will be a lot of wind. From the ridgeline of Yucca Mountain, we might look down at Black Hole, one of the designs for a warning marker from the expert judgment panel. 90,000 square feet of black basalt stone, irregularly carved and cobbled onto the sandy ground. A crazy quilt of parched land, the panel describes it as, cracked, hard to walk on, projecting the image of nothing, a void, uselessness, a place that would seem unwelcoming and uninhabitable because the region will absorb so much heat through these stones that an intruder will simply not be able to stand being there. End quote. Or we might stand on Yucca Mountain and listen to the moans, an echoing oral effect from a series of stone sculptures that would be carved to emit a single pitch in the wind. A minor D, writes the panel, because that note usually signals to our brains that it is sad. They will fill Yucca's basin with a mournful, constant cry, scaring off intruders through an effect that some theorize can be supported by biology, since, quote, pitch extraction from music is accomplished in the inferior colliculus of the brain, which itself is situated in close proximity to other midbrain centers known to be part of mammalian reward systems, according to a study by neuroscientist Martin Braun, entitled Inferior Colliculus as Candidate for Pitch Extraction. He goes on, the pitches found in major chords may therefore have a direct or indirect influence on these reward nuclei, which could be one of the reasons why music can have so strong an emotional impact and why major chords are regarded as joyful and minor chords as mournful. Or we may see forbidding blocks, or we may see rubble landscape. We may see irregular grid, spikes in a field, landscape of thorns, tall leaning stones. We may see a whole catalog of visceral warning markers. Artificially built environments will be meant to enter into to help make their warnings work. But these will be environments, writes the panel in its report, that will exist without transmitting any gestalt for the intruder, without perceivable foci, without the possibility of being understood. Why? We must find ourselves, the panel says, having an experience, an essaying into the purpose of what's apparently purposeless, an essaying that tries desperately to cull significance from the place, but an essaying, says the panel, that must ultimately fail. All human cultures, writes the panel in its report, have tried marking spaces that they have wanted to call the center. It is an impulse to create order out of the chaos that surrounds us, the tribal fire, the village temple, the city's clock tower. But this is why we must invert this symbolic logic of the site, establish a sense of meaninglessness around the entire mountain, suggest that there is no single place of value at the site, that the land itself is shunned, devastated by the earth. End quote. But what we are likely to see instead, according to recent reports from the Department of Energy, is a small series of 20-foot-high monuments at the site. They'll be carved in the shape of pyramids and made from local granite. On their surfaces will be inscriptions in English about the site, plus the date the waste was buried, the date it will be safe, and a small engraved image in the apex of each stone that reproduces the anguished face from Edvard Munch's The Scream. Quote, it's the most recognizable painting in the world, said a Department of Energy spokesman when I called to ask about it. Human culture will probably change dramatically over the next 10,000 years, but human emotions won't. So anyone who comes in contact with this face over the next 10 millennia is going to understand what's up with this site, that there's something about it that's dangerous, scary, and likely to make them sick. I like the idea of a design that just gives the viewer a mood, but we're dealing with life and death here. The most responsible thing we can do in this case is give easily interpretable information. We're trying to help these people. End quote. What we know is that he probably left his house by 5 o'clock. Down the block on Pildristrit, around the corner to the tram, or down the block on Pildristrit by foot to Carl Johan, he would have passed the place that's now a bar called Edvard's Bar and Grill, and then the Old A Slices shop called Edvard's Oven Fresh, and then a store across the street called Scream If You Like Sweets. He could have cut through Grazing Place, where every citizen could keep cattle, and then walk across a bridge that linked the city to its shore. But Edvard says he liked to walk. I need to walk to think. And knew a longer path up Ekberg Hill and through its forest. This was 1883, and it was very likely August. Up the hill, as Edvard walked, he passed couples stretched on blankets, dozens of slanting bodies on the city's lover's lane. Then he reached the forest, once the meadow hillside leveled, and then he walked inside the woods, despite his father's warnings. "There is evil there," his father said, "long forgotten curses from Norway's pagan past." Edvard turned 19 that year and was living still at home. He would have needed his dad's permission to have been out past 6:30. He would have needed to miss his dinner, retired early to his room, established 2 days earlier that he was feeling kind of ill. He would have needed 3 years earlier to have had rheumatic fever and needed 12 years earlier to almost die on Christmas Day. And then he would have needed a low window he could climb through. There was a gray straw hat he wore every single day that I knew him, from the time that he was 15 until he left home for Berlin, according to a memoir by Edvard's closest friend. He would have needed that straw hat, some good walking shoes, the light wool brown coat that all middle-class boys wore. He would have needed 40 minutes to pass through Ekberg's forest and would have needed to understand its ancient pagan history, the 3,000-year-old practice of bringing infants there to die, digging narrow graves over which boulders were then laid so that the child didn't suffocate, but rather starved to death. A practice that was so common by the early 11th century that St. Olaf, the Christian bishop who arrived to baptize pagans, wrote a letter to Norwegians enforcing 3 new Christian laws. Number 1, there shall be no more folk singing in God's northern kingdom, for these are not the sounds our Lord and Savior wants to hear. Number 2, there shall desist immediately all the eating of horse meat. And number 3, because all Christian lives should begin with holy baptism, no longer may any child be left exposed if it's unwanted. The last of which proved so controversial for the pagans that one decade later, in the famous Gulatings Law, a revision was applied in which, quote, no healthy child may be exposed if it's unwanted, except if his toes are in the place of his knees, whose chin is turned around and connected to the shoulder, the neck upon his breast, the skin on his legs turning scaly in complexion, his 2 eyes on the sides of the poor child's head, or goat horns, a dog's tail. The child must be brought to the forest, therefore, and buried where neither men nor cattle ever go. End quote. Conditions which were apparently not uncommon at the time, for, as Jenny Jokins explains in Women in Old Norse Society, the low-valleyed villages and the high walls of mountains confined the majority of Norwegians to their homes, forcing upon the culture a certain amount of inbreeding, and thus resulting in increasingly deformed infants at birth. He would have needed to know the phrase, "I christen thee at random, John or Joanna, the spell St. Olaf wrote to ward off any utbird, the wide-eyed, pale, and hairless ghosts of Norway's exposed children, thin, hairless, shrieking souls who haunted Ekberg's forest, looking for their parents." He would have needed to know that night, if one mistook him for its father, clinging to his back with a black and gaping jaw, that the only way to rid oneself of that point of an utbird is to convince the child to kill itself and then bury it again. But what he wouldn't have ever known during his walk there as a teen is that his childhood friend in 15 years would kill himself in Ekberg. Wouldn't have ever known, once he had reached the other side, looking down the hill to the city's ancient shore, that his sister would be committed, that he would never visit her, and that eventually she would die along the city's shoreline, through the forest, down that hill, in a loud and red asylum, from which the screams that were heard were so consistently high-pitched that local residents never forgot that it had been once a slaughterhouse. Wouldn't have ever known that this view he now walked toward would eventually be the city's most famous for postcards, most famous for drug arrests, most infamous for rape. wouldn't have ever seen as he brushed off the forest leaves, the stone marker that the city will never place upon that spot, commemorating where Edvard first felt that he was hurt. Won't see the bench that's there, the one turned the wrong direction. Wouldn't need to cross the highway where there is no crossing walk, approaching the metal guardrail, which no longer is a railing. Wouldn't need to glimpse below to where the tracks are running now, to the service road, the power grid, the industry of concrete ports and forklift trucks and corrugated terminals for Unocal and Exxon and BP and Shell. Didn't have to reach the bottom of that hill among the rocks. Didn't need his parents dead, favorite sister, younger brother, older sister, to be dead, to help bleach their bloody sheets to light brown mottled spots with urine. Didn't need to hate his father, love with fear his smiling mother, never needed to kiss a boy before he'd ever kissed a girl, and then to go on living without anyone to kiss. Didn't need those critics saying that he'd invent something brand new, that he would feel an ancient emptiness at the center of the world and then gather up that emptiness into something that had borders, a face, the chance to see what's wrong. Never needed someone saying that God is not in every detail, that God is sometimes in experience, someone to write letters to, from whom he could get letters back, take train trips with and snuggle with, and then never to have met. He didn't need the earth 10 million years ago to rumble from the bottom of its ocean floor a mountain, a 4,000-acre island in Indonesia called Rakata, one of 13,000 islands in the narrow Sunda Strait on which the fabled Krakatoa, a mountain on the mountain, a volcano whose eruption in 1400 BCE is said to have caused tsunamis that were so big they sank Atlantis, a volcano whose eruption in 537 is said to have clouded skies so thoroughly that summer that it snowed in Rome in June, that crops in Europe failed, that floods appeared in deserts, that wandering Mongolians retreating from the weather fled with tribal families west into Eurasia, ended the Persian Empire, and started modern Islam. A volcano that locals called the pulsing heart of all the world never needed to erupt with so much power once again that on August 25th, the week preceding Edvard's walk, it practiced an eruption at 5:30 in the evening, then practiced at 6:40, then 8:21, then 10, 10:50, midnight, and 1, and then finally at 3:30 on August 26th, it erupted with a force that razed 160 villages, killed 40,000 people, burst so loudly that radiometrists have called the mountain's blast the second loudest noise ever heard by human beings, sending out concussive waves 7 times around the world and exploding up a mile high and then exploding out, blanketing the atmosphere with 227 million tons of new debris, over 2/3 of the island's entire rocky mass, dust that drifted across the earth so thoroughly and fast that by August 28th, British offices in Delhi were reporting having seen a bank of yellow clouds at night. By August 29th, they were orange in Madrid, and by August 31st, they mixed with moisture over London from where a cold front pushed the dust and rain westward over Norway, where the nights were very windy and where light revealed that dust as red in skies that bled already. His name was Levi Presley, the Vegas paper said. 16 years old and from the north edge of town. I tried to call his parents, but their number wasn't listed. I tried to go to his funeral, but his service wasn't public. I even called an ad that I had found in the Yellow Pages, Venus Investigations, a private investigation firm for sensitive local cases. Venus had a smoker's voice, a barking dog and screaming kids in jeopardy in the background. $400 cash, she said, for vital information. I sent the money wired. 5 days later, Venus called with Levi's middle name. She told me Levi's parents had first met in Arizona. She told me Levi hadn't ever committed any crimes. She told me where they lived, and then she said, "And there's a tape." "A tape?" I asked. "A security tape. Every incident in a hotel in the city of Las Vegas is recorded by thousands of cameras that are embedded in the ceilings. So if someone's cheating at cards," Venus said over the phone, "or if there's a fight somewhere, a murder, or any kind of shit, the hotel can edit together all the relevant footage and send it to the Vegas police. It limits their liability." "And they made one of these of Levi?" I asked. "That's what I'm hearing, man. Yeah. I wonder if I could see it." "Now, why the fuck would you want that?" Levi liked going to Applebee's. In-N-Out. A place that's now out of business. He wore a lot of white, sometimes a silver chain, and purple-tinted glasses. He liked a girl named Mary, also M&M, was called by his mom, "My Little Booper." His Chrysler LeBaron was Goose. He said that he was sad. I asked about what. He said some stuff. I asked, like what? "Doesn't matter." "Why not?" "Just sucks." Hung up. I sat beside the Presleys on a green leather Lazy Boy sectional recliner with the ceramic black urn of Levi's ashes in my lap. We were beneath their cathedral ceiling. We were watching TV Land. We had nuts and we had Triscuits and we had spinach dip and Coke. We ate soup and then a salad and then chicken and then brownies. We looked for several minutes at his art in their new den. We drove across the valley to Taekwondo for Kids, the studio Levi practiced at and coached others after school. We sat in his coach's office among piles of trophy pieces. We helped screw the golden kickers into braided sequined pillars and then dark wooden bases that read "Achievement" on their plaques. We learned that Taekwondo only has 9 levels. There is white, yellow, orange, green, blue, purple, red, and brown, and then a whole series of advanced black belts, each with its own complexity of reticulated levels, 9 tiers of 9 grades in 9 stages without end, because Korean culture does not believe we can be perfect. We agreed this was significant because he fell for 9 seconds. I also learned that God resides in the 9th order of heaven, that before he could receive the secret meaning of runes, Odin had to hang for 9 days on a tree. There are always 9 muses alive at any time, always 9 maidens in ancient Celtic myths, always 9 floors in the most sacred Buddhist temples. If a servant finds 9 peas in a pod and places that pod on the floor of her kitchen, the first man who comes in and tramples that pod will be the man she marries. Possession, they say, is 9/10 of the law. 9 people, says the Bible, will be stoned on Judgment Day. "Thrice to thine and thrice to mine and thrice again to make up 9 is how Shakespeare's 3 witches guaranteed Macbeth's charm. For 9, said Pythagoras, is that which brings completion. I think we knew, however, that he really fell for 8. Drove back to where they lived. Made plans for dinner soon. Kissed and hugged and waved goodbye and said we'd be in touch. I left Las Vegas 5 months after Mom and I arrived. At some point it came clear while I was visiting the Presleys that in fact I had not spoken to their son the night he died. It was clear as I left Vegas that some other boy had called. Clear that if I point to something seeming like significance, there is the possibility that nothing real is there. Sometimes we misplace knowledge in pursuit of information. Sometimes our wisdom too, in pursuit of what's called knowledge. Levi came home at 2 a.m. Ori came home at 2:30 a.m., but neither Gail, his mom, nor Levi Sr., his dad, can remember exactly which. This doesn't matter, though, they both say, because his curfew was 11. We didn't say anything immediately because he had a tournament the next day and we knew he needed his sleep, Gail says. Levi slept for 5 hours, or he slept for 4.5 hours. Then he woke, showered, dressed, ate nothing, drove to his tournament, stretched, cheered, competed, lost, drove back home, slammed the car door, slammed the front door, slammed his room door, and stayed there. He was probably in there 2 hours, Gail says. Is that unusual? That's not unusual, she says, but after a tournament, I guess it'd be a little unusual because he really liked to talk about his meets when he came home. After another hour, Gail says she and her husband called Levi into their bedroom and told him that he was grounded for staying out past his curfew and for being at a party to which they suspected other kids had brought drugs. Gail says she heard ecstasy. Levi Sr. says pot. Levi said fine, threw his cell phone on their bed, and told them that they might as well take that too. He slammed their bedroom door, slammed the front door, slammed his car door, and drove away. Is that unusual? That's not unusual. He's a teenager, says Gail. But then again, we had just grounded him. Levi drove east, down Pleasant Plains Way, turned right onto Rainy River, left onto Joe Michael, right onto Shermcreft, right onto Gowan, left onto Rainbow, right onto Cheyenne, south onto Interstate 15 past two exits, then right onto Sahara, left onto Vegas, left onto Baltimore, and right into the parking garage at the Stratosphere Hotel. He found a space on the fifth level, the blue level, three spaces away from the elevator. It was 5:18 p.m. Levi then either walked down two flights of stairs to the third level of the garage, the orange level of the garage, where a skywalk connects parking to the hotel's registration, or Levi waited there in order to take the elevator. This was Saturday, however, and in the early evening hours on Saturdays in Vegas, the elevators everywhere are slow. Once inside the casino, Levi walked down its red staircase and past the group tour's reception desk on his right side and Roxy's Diner on his left, where a disc jockey plays 50s rock and the waitstaff sings. Because it was a Saturday in early evening at Roxy's, the place definitely would have been hopping, said their featured waiter, Johnny Potroast, who thinks he was on duty that night, he said. And who knows, I was probably singing Grease Lightning, because it's a high-energy number, and that's what we want on a Saturday night. When Johnny starts singing, the waitresses pull microphones from the pouches of their aprons and jump onto the partitions between the diner's booths. They wave their order pads in the air and shimmy in place while diners lift forkfuls of potatoes to their mouths. And Johnny jumps high and lands on his knees and holds his eyes shut as he holds the long ing and the long final high note in Lightning. Levi then walked past the casino's 48 card tables and 2,000 slot machines, some of which are named after popular American television shows, I Dream of Jeannie, Wheel of Fortune, Hogan's Heroes, and some of which are named after popular American merchandise, Spam, Harley Davidson, the board game Battleship, and some of which are not named after anything at all. Money to Burn, the Nickel Game, Push It, Push It, Push It. And then Levi walked toward the woman at the foot of the escalator who sells cigarettes and cigars and battery-operated necklaces from a small tray that hangs from her shoulders below her breasts. There is a blue star necklace and a red orb necklace and a yellow cross necklace available for sale, each of which glows steadily or flickers randomly or even can be programmed to reflect your own mood. Amy, who was on duty that night, knows Levi didn't buy anything because she would have remembered a boy buying a necklace, she said. Usually the guys who buy stuff are buying stuff for raves, and I always ask them where they're going because I'm a raver too. Then he went up the escalator. Levi would have stood in line at the hotel's ticket booth in order to buy a ticket to the top of the hotel's tower. Because it was Saturday in early evening, however, there would have been a long line at the hotel ticket booth. Levi would have stood between the fanny packs and the midriffs and the open containers and the flip-flops and noticed the backlit advertisements behind the hotel's ticket booth for the upcoming Billy Ray Cyrus concert in September, or the heavyweight boxing extravaganza in November, or the Stratosphere's new guaranteed refund slot program, which pays players back 15% of what they've lost. And then he would have purchased his ticket from one of the three ticket booth attendants for $4 rather than $8, because he was a Las Vegas resident. And finally, he would have begun to walk toward the tower's elevator at the other end of the Stratosphere's Tower of Shops mall. Past Flag Mania. Past Alpaca Pete's, past the fabulous Las Vegas Magic Shop and the Great Wall of Magnets and Gold Fathers, a kiosk that sells gold chains by the yard. Levi walked past Aquamassage, Häagen-Dazs, Temporary Henna Airbrush Tattoo, past Perfume Mania, Leatherland, Gifts Plus Arcade, past Coming Soon to This Location, another exciting shop, past Stitch It On's Hat Embroidery Kiosk, past Vegas Candle's huge blowout sale, past Wetzel's Pretzels, Cleo's Fine Jewelers, and CJ's Casino Emporium, which sells vintage 1991 slot machines for $4,995. Levi walked past Breathe, an oxygen bar, where you can revive your body, renew your spirit, relax your mind, and feel more alive for $15 per 15-minute dose, which includes your choice of one of 18 complementary oxygen aromas, such as Nirvana, Watermelon, Clarity, Peach, Sublime, Cappuccino, Synergy, Dream, Chocolate, Eclipse, Revitalize, or Tangerine. The girls at Breathe don't remember Levi stopping by the bar that evening, but they do recall hearing about his jump once it occurred. "All I want to say," said Jenny, who manages the bar, "is that it's awful that it happened, but I know for a fact that he wasn't on O2 when he did it." Then Levi reached the end of the mall and walked down a ramp to wait in the next line. Because it was Saturday in early evening, however, there would have been a long line wrapping around the rope corrals four or five times and stretching back into the mall. Harold, a security guard, eventually would have asked Levi if he had any metal in his pockets, and because he did, Levi would have emptied his car keys into a white Stratosphere slot machine coin bucket, walked through the metal detector, picked up his keys, and walked into a narrow hallway to wait for the elevator to the tower. Because it was Saturday in early evening, however, the group with which Levi had waited in line would have had to wait in that hallway even longer. It would have been crowded and hot and yellow-lit that night, and for the long meanwhile during which Levi waited, he might have glanced over the railing and seen below him the Stratosphere's amusement area that's called Stratofare, a passageway of carnival games beside the hotel's pool. There is the softball throwing game called Cat Splat, and the ring throwing game called Orb Atoss, and the ride at your own risk mechanical bull that's called Vegas Cowboy. Warning. This mechanical bull is designed to simulate the motion of a live bull. Therefore, there is a high probability that the rider will be thrown from and or struck by this mechanical bull. This mechanical bull is a heavy-duty machine that will violently, erratically, and unpredictably spin and rotate the rider at high speeds. You must be at least 13 years old to ride this bull. End quote. Then he entered the elevator. Inside, Levi would have been greeted by a young woman, perhaps Caroline, who would have worn black pants and a pink and teal Stratosphere polo shirt, and who would have announced, once the doors had closed, that Levi and the elevator's other 25 maximum occupants that night would soon be traveling 1,858 feet per minute to the top of the Stratosphere Tower, even though they would only be traveling 857 feet to the top of the stratosphere tower, together in a double-decker elevator in which they would have been so closely arranged that it would have been impossible for them to have counted themselves, some of whom might have been drunk, some of whom might have been talking over the elevator operator's narrative of their ascent, and some of whom might have interrupted the operator to ask her several times on the same trip while giggling how many times each day she goes up and down the shaft. Then Levi would have exited and walked into the blue-lit hallway of the first level of the tower's two-level observation deck, past a closed gift shop, past a closed snack bar, past the picture-paned radio station that had broadcast nothing for years, and into the carpeted round enclosure of the deck, whose floor-to-ceiling windows slant inward toward the ground so that visitors, while looking down at Las Vegas, toe-to-pane at the windows, might experience what pre-opening hotel press releases called, in 1994, free fall. Then he walked upstairs, outside. It was Saturday in early evening, and there were many people around. Some kids running around the paved deck of the tower, some adults looking through the coin-operated telescopes, making sure they wouldn't work before first depositing a coin, some older people holding on to the inside chain-link fence of the deck, readjusting their grips each time a copter flew by. Levi walked left, east, away from where the sun had begun its own decline, and leaned briefly against the 4-foot-high railing fence of the deck while a bride and groom took photographs of each other, and then of the view, and then of the last 200 feet of the tower above. Then Levi climbed over the 4-foot-high railing fence, stepped into what Stratosphere Security calls the moat, a 6-foot-wide concrete-paved space between the 4-foot-high fence on the deck's inside perimeter and the 10-foot-high fence at the very edge of the perimeter, and then Levi climbed over the 10-foot-high fence and sat down. It was Saturday, an early evening, and an alarm was ringing in the hotel's security office. Levi sat on the ledge for 48 seconds before anyone on the deck walked by. Now the sun was gone. Saturday was night, and the valley in which Levi had grown up became bright, and it stayed bright, all the way to the invisible black mountains around it, the wall that would keep the city forever the shape it now was. Security officer Frank then approached Levi from the left, the east, and said, "Hey," or he said, "Hey, kid," or he said, "Kid, no," or he said, "Nothing." And it was his presence alone that caused Levi to turn his head to the left, stand up on the ledge, wave to the security officer who does not appear on the screen of the video on which Levi is waving, and jump. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
John, thank you. That was a stunning reading.
Thank you.
Really transfixing, disturbing, and beautiful.
Thanks.
What I want to ask you is about a mountain. It's not just about a mountain. you touched on this a little bit in your introduction, but it would seem that Yucca Mountain alone would constitute a book. It's a huge topic, and it allows you to essentially touch on our fear of extinction and get into science and geology. It could have been enough.
Mm-hmm.
So how was it that so much else could belong in this book? And what was that process like for you to make this book about so many things, about Levi, about your mother, about Yucca?
How is it, or why is it? Or
How did it come to exist as a book? Because I think if you were to read a description of that, it wouldn't seem as though these things go together.
Oh, sure. You know, that it's a fantastic question, and I don't have a fantastic answer for it. Though I do have a long answer. and that answer is that I don't think the book is about Yucca Mountain, though ostensibly it is, and it is ostensibly in part about Levi. For me, the book is about what propelled my research and my writing it was the idea of the uselessness of information after a certain point. And especially while researching Yucca Mountain and discovering, which I wasn't expecting when I started looking into Yucca, discovering lots of scientific studies that were being done by the government's own scientists that were completely contradicting each other in terms of their findings. This idea that Yucca Mountain is supposedly, they say, the most studied piece of land on the planet at this point, that we have surrounded ourselves with information about Yucca, facts about Yucca, data, armed ourselves with it, and yet we still really can't agree whether or not it's an appropriate place to store nuclear waste.
And that might be true of any place in the world.
It probably is. Right. And when Levi then came into my consciousness, and I ended up by necessity learning about suicide, not just in Vegas, but suicide in general, and then ultimately meeting Levi's parents very soon after Levi died, who were just shell-shocked. Those two subjects started speaking to one another because suicide, too, suicide is the ultimate unknowable, I think. Mm-hmm. I haven't ever experienced a suicide, not until very recently, but it seems that you're left with only questions. And so this idea that the Department of Energy would like us to believe about Yucca, that if we just study it enough, it's going to reveal itself to us, or we're going to find what we need to know about it, or we're going to be able to prove that it works, is fascinating to me, because that hasn't been the case after 25 years. And so this thing that makes us human, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the only thing that seems to separate us as a species is this ability to reason our way out of or into anything, just doesn't work after or all the time or often. And it was really Levi that opened up that idea for me. And once that idea of our limited capacity to know things was revealed to me, I was able to then, you know, mine other subjects. Mm. And once I also allowed myself to not make Yucca the subject, I think the book was able to absorb more.
It's completely persuasive in the book, and that's why I wanted to ask, because these topics seem so unlikely, but that's a beautiful explanation. One of the amazing things you do in the book all throughout that struck me when I first read it was the way you use lists to unfurl this incredible cascade of information that becomes poetic and instructional and terrifying. And could you talk about your interest in the list? I know you're somewhat known for your use of it, but in some sense, list doesn't even seem to be the right word for the kind of cadence that occurs late in the book, the part you read when we hear what wouldn't have needed to have happened for Edvard Munch and what he wouldn't have known.
you set up a pattern and you repeat it, and it allows you to propels you through the story. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about how you find your way into those models? It seems to mark the entire book to me.
Sure. This might be two different issues, but I guess in what I read, it's happening. Both things are happening. I'm generally interested in lists because they seem to be able to work wonders. They can appear to be suspending a text, and yet by the time you come out from the other end of a list, you've discovered that they've actually progressed you and the idea of the book forward. And I also liked the idea of lists for this book because they are on their surface very silly, and yet I like the idea that many of the lists turn sinister, or they turn serious, or they shake off their silliness after a while, and we find ourselves just being barraged with very disturbing information or images. And as well, in some ways, I'm not convinced by any of those marker ideas for Yucca Mountain, but instead have started thinking that maybe the best way to mark a place like Yucca is with our own crap, our own garbage. And so I like the idea of the list, which can feel like a garbage heap or a scrap heap, contributing to telling the story or describing Yucca Mountain. But the cadence
I'm curious, when you talk about Yucca and a way to signal the future, did you have a favorite among the many strange methods?
I like the
It'd be a great moans. National competition.
I like
think.
The... There was a competition.
Oh, there was?
There was.
Too bad.
The competition had nothing to do with the Department of Energy's expert judgment panel. It was something that the University of Nevada at Las Vegas put on, and the winner was a design student from LA who proposed developing a mutant yucca plant that would be a very bright blue as it grew and bloomed. So that it would spread over Yucca and just kind of glow and look nasty. And so he won. But I love that moans. I love the idea of, you know, taking a field trip to Yucca in the future, and with, you know, before we even see Yucca, we come into the atmosphere of this, you know, as the wind is going through it. I love that idea.
That
I think that's...
It's nice, too, that we're so concerned about the safety of people. So remote from us and rather oblivious to our own safety. But it's interesting to see the government. Is there any other example of them being so concerned about the safety of a group of people? It's not even right to say they haven't been born yet. That seems very understated.
Yeah. You know, the panel actually proposed early on that they asked permission from the Department of Energy that they not try to design a marker for 10,000 years, but rather for maybe 500 or 1,000 years, and then establish a kind of relay system,
right,
a marker that would say to, you know, generations 500 years from now, here's this thing. This is what's going on with Yucca.
Yeah.
We don't have a language that is going to make sense to
it's
people
like
10,000 years in the future. So why don't you redesign this marker in a way that'll make sense to you and plan for it to last 500 years and then tell the next people to do that. And the Department of Energy said that that would be irresponsible. That
we can't trust those people.
Right. That we
Who
had to do it for 10,000
like.
Years.
I wonder if there's a similar plan for the Bible to because I'd like to move on. I know that I first read your essay about Levi quite a while ago, and I know it has a storied history. I think you had not yet written about Yucca when you were first writing about Levi, as far as I know, or maybe
I hadn't
yet
about it,
published.
No. No.
So I think Harper's assigned this essay to you, and once they, I think that they started to fact check it, and they got through the first page, and then there was a conference call, which resulted in you all going your separate ways, and you brought the essay to the Believer, where it was then fact checked again, rather thoroughly. And now, in a year from now, you're publishing a new book called The Lifespan of Facts. And it'll be published by Norton, and it's the Levi essay, along with all the fact-checking notes. I've just read it. I read it on the plane coming out here, and it's completely fascinating. It's a battle between you and the fact-checker. This poor young man doing his job, sentence after sentence after sentence, and you sort of saying, you know, leave me alone, don't touch my work, back off. And so, and now you're publishing it, so this essay gets a new life. So I'm curious, what argument, if any, are you hoping to make by revealing this? You're going to be drawing a lot of attention to the way you work, in my mind, very convincingly, with or against facts, the way you sublimate them to for a much larger purpose. So what does the publication of this document mean to you? What sort of conversation would you like to start?
Sure. I do realize once the book comes out that I'll never be commissioned again to write for any of those kinds of magazines. But I'm willing to sacrifice myself so that we can have a reasoned conversation about the issue of veracity in nonfiction. We have not so much a conversation, but a screaming battle whenever a scandal erupts, like the James Frey thing from a number of years ago, which wasn't very reasonable, and you know, Oprah became involved and told this poor guy that he had betrayed her and betrayed America, and it was at that point impossible for us to have a serious conversation about it. So my hope is that we talk honestly about the choices that nonfiction writers make, but in fact all writers make, that often involve altering reality in the service of a better reading experience for the reader. Not necessarily, or not at all, I would hope, in order to betray the reader. It all actually is in an effort to get what's on the page to be as enjoyable, though maybe still challenging, but as exciting as possible.
Is one of the challenges to you that an essay writer is often seen as a journalist and is then held to that set of standards?
Yeah, well, I work in a genre that's called nonfiction. Sure. I don't use that term. In the classroom, I don't use the term, and I don't allow it even to come into the classroom. I tell my students we're essayists and we're writing essays. And the term nonfiction is never raised, but it is what we're known as. And it's a wildly dangerous term, I think, because what it immediately suggests is that anything happening, anything being written underneath that term is automatically not art. I mean, that's what the term means, is not art. Fiction comes from the Latin fictio, which means to arrange, to form, to shape, which isn't unique just to fiction. It's a fundamental activity of art, to take an experience in the world and to forge it into something, to arrange it so that it can speak to your experience of the world. That's what the artist does. And so by calling the work that occurs in nonfiction, not fictional, not art, something that hasn't been arranged or shaped or formed or made, is to relegate the writers of the genre to the role of essentially reporting the world as opposed to experiencing and reimagining the world, which is
sure.
what art is supposed to do. The term essay, why I demand my students when they're in class, at least with me, that they use it, is because it does in fact describe more accurately what these texts are doing, which is exploring something. The term essay means an attempt to sure. do something, and that's it. It's not a promise, it's not a guarantee, the way that the term nonfiction suggests to the reader that they can trust what's happening in the genre, that there's that it's been verified, it has a stamp mm-hmm. of approval. And the essay is completely unconcerned with that and is concerned instead with the experience on the page.
Do you feel that sensibility and explanation of the essay is shared by readers of the essay?
No, I understand that. It's not.
No, it's a fascinating question. You know, early in his career, Freud considered calling his books novels because there was no precedent for this kind of work. Right. This social science really didn't exist. And he was looking for legitimacy. He wanted to increase his believability, and why, you know, choosing fiction would have done that is a bit of a mystery to me. But I guess my question is, when you describe what you do, I wonder why don't you call yourself a novelist? Because it would take care of that fight. Is there something about the truth seemingness of the essay, trafficking as it would seem to in real life a little bit, mm-hmm. that you're benefiting from? Or have you considered calling? I mean, you could have called the essay a story.
Mm-hmm.
And it might have been welcome in a certain artistic community of storytelling.
Sure. It's an excellent question. I will try to find my way to an answer, but temporarily to hedge it, I'll say when I was in graduate school, I think I said in my introduction I wasn't completely happy because I wasn't comfortable writing and talking about the kind of nonfiction that was popular then. So I actually simultaneously joined another writing program at the university, not fiction though. I joined poetry. I've never considered calling what I do fiction, partly because I don't know the form well enough, but also because poetry does have a closer relationship to the essay, to the activity of the essay, to the exploratory nature of the essay,
sure.
the associative nature of the essay. The issue of the question of whether I'm getting anything out of whether we get extra points from readers with the suggestion
I ask this because as a fiction writer and knowing lots of fiction writers, there's a sense that over in the land of nonfiction,
uh-huh.
where many more books are sold and the story seems somehow connected to the real world rather than the land of make-believe, which we don't have the luxury to care about, it would seem that the true story has prominence. Mm-hmm. At least at this moment. Mm-hmm. And I don't at all mean this to be accusatory, but it seems that working within that paradigm and then but yet taking the liberties of the fiction writer, well, actually I just think it's brilliant and great.
Uh-huh.
Because I think the fiction writer dreams of believability. That's the uh-huh. fantasy. The uh-huh. fantasy is okay. to be believed so that any crazy thing you say is believed. The essay writer seems almost to start with that. Not
sure.
really a question.
Sure. No, I would agree. I don't really know how to answer it. I've always found, though, I don't think a writer deserves credit just for having lived a life. So I'm really made uneasy by these memoirs that ride on the fantasticness of the personal experience that's being relayed in the book. I had this traumatic experience, sure. Now let me tell you about it. Or I slept with my dad, now let me tell you about it. I slept with the family dog. These are real memoirs, let me tell you about it. Goethe once said that experience is only half of experience. And I think he meant that you can only ride that train so long. You have to bring something else into the text. And there's too much of nonfiction that relies on the sensationalness of the idea that all of this really happened. And I think that that's unhelpful for the genre. So I don't know. I would like to say no, I'm above that. I don't. I'm uninterested in getting those extra points from the reader. In the same way that when I'm at a movie, and suddenly we see on the screen right after the opening credits that this is based on a true story. Yeah. I hate that. I feel completely manipulated, as if suddenly I'm going to experience the movie differently.
Well, I know a filmmaker who said those are the most powerful words in Hollywood, based on a true story.
Uh-huh.
Right? What if it said, this is completely made up? There's a way of saying, it's sort of like saying, this can't, won't matter. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, there was a... When this book came out, there was a novel that had come out right around the same time by, I think, a great fiction writer whose first collection of stories I loved. I'm not going to name him. I really do respect him. But this novel was about a financial crisis in America. And it was coming out just as we were experiencing a financial crisis in America. And it was the details of it were eerily similar to what we were experiencing. And because our books were coming out around the same time, we often found ourselves in public radio stations waiting, you know, in the green rooms together. And I often heard him described, because of the similarity between his story about a financial crisis in America and the financial crisis in America, as a prophet. I think, in fact, I think NPR called him a prophet. And I, you know, would sit there ready for my interview and then would be asked, you know, why I'm a big fat liar. And you know, I know this is...
Well, in 10,000 years...
This is. I know this is sort of juvenile, but why isn't...
I think you're right to be upset.
When fiction... I mean, it used to be that first novels were, in fact, memoirs, that young novelists actually
wrote
memoirs.
The idea is you're writing about yourself.
Sure. Yeah. Now it's different. They write memoirs, I guess. But when fiction... When fiction feels, you know, so similar to a financial crisis in America, why isn't the fiction writer scolded for not being imaginative enough? Yet when the nonfiction writer or the essayist strays too far from the facts or, in fact, uses the imagination, they're chastised.
The fiction writer is being scolded, but in a dark alley by people who... don't matter. You're right, though. Uh-huh. You know, the policing of the factual—it's huge. And I really admire the way you take such a risk to put yourself out there. But also, I think to prove that, in some sense, there's so much that's inconsequential in this obsession with facts, and so much more that's possible. And I think it's just something you do page after page in your work, and that seems to me the proof that everyone needs. And And I think readers will start to catch up with it. I guess for a last question, I'd like to ask you if you ever imagine an ideal reader. Does this consume you? Do you not think about it? Could you articulate what an ideal reader would be for you?
I do have readers in mind. I realized, this is actually somewhat sad, I realized recently that most of the people these days I have in mind when I'm writing are now gone. They're dead. Early on, I have a background in classics, and I imagine folks like Cicero and Plutarch, who I was in love with as a child, being...
They've been dead for quite a while.
They have been dead for a while. But I imagine that I was trying to, you know, do them well, so that
sure.
when
You're
I died
in
and ended up in the same place that they are, perhaps they would say, good job. But as I, you know, as I got older, the people I wanted to write for were people I either knew or didn't know, but were writers out there in the world. And just, you know, a few years ago, the last of them died. That isn't answering your question of who the ideal reader is, but I guess for me, the ideal reader is the smartest reader I can find,
sure.
which probably means that I'm limiting my audience. I don't mean that...
If it's just that one person. Yeah. they might buy books for their friends and family, though.
I would like... I don't think this is going to happen in my lifetime, but I would like my students, for example, to have an audience that understands the heritage of
sure.
the essay and understands that nonfiction is not a new thing, that it's more than just memoir, that this issue about facts is not inconsequential, but it's not really what defines this form as art. It'll happen. I won't necessarily see it, but I think they will.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Heaney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.